Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Brief on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McCrae. Coming up on this week's programme, it is our 2024 Best Of show, and we have some amazing interviews on the way. It's quite an eclectic mix, and unless you've been listening every single week and listen to every single feature, I recommend you stick with us because we have some wonderful stuff. We're going to be talking about the realities of interstellar travel, we'll hear from a tornado-chasing scientist, and we'll discuss actual scientifically verifiable life after death. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can tweet us, we're at Newstalk Science, or you can WhatsApp us, 087 1400 106. But first up, earlier in the year, we learned of a group called the Interstellar Research Group, a bunch of scientists, engineers and science fiction fans who were carefully and methodically undertaking all sorts of research to see if one day we could make interstellar travel happen. It's such an incredibly fascinating subject. We spoke with Les Johnson, who's a co-editor of a book for the group and chief technologist with NASA at the George C. Marshall Space Flight Center. I started off by asking him why time is a challenge when it comes to interstellar travel.
Well, one thing we've learned about distances to the stars is they're really, really vast. And when you start talking about covering these incredible distances that we talk about something moving as rapidly as light taking years to cover, we have to start thinking about nature's speed limit, which is the speed of light. And according to Einstein and everything we've observed in nature, that is the upper speed limit. So if you're talking about going to another star at these distances, even if you travel as fast as nature is going to allow, it will take years, decades, or centuries to get there. And I don't believe anytime soon, maybe never, will we have spacecraft that can go really, really close to the speed of light, because the challenges of doing that are just tremendous. So even if we get it like 10% the speed of light, to get to the nearest star suddenly is 40 to 50 years, if not hundreds or thousands of years. And so when we think about mounting a voyage like this, it makes me think of what the cathedrals of Europe or the Great Wall of China, where people who began building these things have a vision of the future that won't be completed in their lifetime. It's something that they have to believe in, that's worth doing, that's important, that might take generations to accomplish. And that's the notion of time. I think we really don't appreciate in our own history, because we're limited to our, you know, 40 and 10 years that we live, that some things are just going to take longer than the human experience.
In this particularly, you talk about clock images and travelers' clocks in relativistic travel. What does that mean?
Well, wow. You know, that's the topic for a whole lecture by a bunch of physicists with a chalkboard and lots of chalk and lots of time. What we have observed in nature, and it has been measured, is that the rate at which time passes depends upon your frame of reference. And what I mean by that is, if you're in a frame of reference on a spacecraft or something that has accelerated and is moving faster, the rate at which your clock ticks is different than my clock here on the ground. We have measured this on the space station. We have taken very precise atomic clocks on the space station and found that they run slightly slower on the space station than they do on the ground. We have done experiments in the laboratory looking at the half-lives of certain radioisotopes, because nature says that certain radioactive particles will decay in a certain amount of time. Well, ones that are moving really fast, their decay time is different because they're moving really fast. And so it turns out that this notion of space being absolute and time being some invariant absolute is totally false. That is a perspective that we humans have because we're all in the same reference frame. Once you get out and you start moving at some significant fraction of the speed of light, let's say we get up to 90% or better, you could potentially notice on a voyage to the stars that from your perspective on the spacecraft, the trip might take a certain number of years, but on Earth, twice that many years will have passed. So you have to be able to correlate how fast you're going, calculate how fast your clock is ticking relative to those you left behind, and be able to compare that, or you will not understand what's happening back home. So you might get to Proxima Centauri B, one of the nearest stars with a planet around it, and it might take you subjective time on the spacecraft, you know, 40 to 50 years to get there, and 100 years has passed back on Earth, just depending on how fast you're going.
Wow.
So it makes a big difference, and you have to account for that in everything. And lest your listeners think that this is some esoteric problem that doesn't impact real life, it impacts everything. GPS, which we use for precise positioning here on the Earth, has to take into account relativistic effects, not only from the velocity of the spacecraft, but the fact that the Earth has mass, and that affects the rate at which time passes. So all of those corrections are factored in to something as simple as you being able to get across town using the mapping software on your phone. In order for that to be precise, some of Einstein's relativistic corrections have to be applied.
I'd never really thought of it in that practical terms. Of course, I'd heard of, you know, relativity and so on. But when it comes to applying that these sort of ideas to something as enormous as such an immensely long journey, of course, some of these, you know, these effects are going to be pretty large. What sort of effect will that have on communicating with a generational ship?
Well, I also read a lot of science fiction and write science fiction where people have played around with this, right? You go on the voyage and you have, let's say you're a parent and you just had a child born. When you arrive, a few decades have passed, but they may die of old age before you get there, right? So I think there'll be not only the technical implications of keeping up with what's happening at home, right? But I think there'll be the personal dynamic for any explorers that go, not only leaving things physically behind, but leaving behind any hope of connecting at all with your former life. And I think that psychologically would be really challenging.
The concept of a generational ship we've talked about on the program before, but I suppose when it gets down to the nitty gritty, you need to have a think about exactly how many people you send on a trip, because presumably it'd be very, very difficult and very time intensive, cost intensive to undertake any sort of a voyage like this. There's some work undergoing that you report in the book about figuring out optimal crew size. Tell me a little bit about that. How many and what sort of a crew are we thinking currently, according to this research?
Well, there's a lot of disagreement on that, as you might expect. And the author who contributed this has tried to distill that into the chapter. It's Andreas Hein. Think of it this way. If you have to take a voyage that's going to take 1,000 years, say, to some habitable planet somewhere, you're not going to be bringing a lot of ships, most likely. It's going to be a long voyage. You get one shot at it, maybe two. So you can't count on genetic diversity from home of lots of smaller ships coming with new blood all the time. It's going to have to be one big one. So your population density to get the genetic diversity might be really high. But that's assuming that we have kind of the genetic diversity that we have today, where two people meet, fall in love, have babies.
Yeah.
And do that. But with the advances that we've made in genetic engineering and genetic editing, you know, you could potentially have a sampling of fewer people and engineer differences so you don't get the problem of intermarrying and the gene pool being too narrow when you reach your destination. People have also taken the idea of bringing frozen embryos of huge population diversity along with you. But then you get into all sorts of ethical questions, right? As exemplified today, at least in the U.S., and I know in other places, about when does life begin, you know, the whole issue of abortion and all those things. And then you leave the realm of the purely technical and you get into the moral and ethical, which is something that we'll have to consider. Now, if the voyage isn't that long and you have a really fast ship and where you could conceivably reach your destination in a decade or a few decades, which is really, you know, high speed travel, then suddenly you have the option of, well, you don't worry about the genetic diversity as much because there'll be many ships following you.
Right.
And it would be more like the Polynesians when they settled the Pacific Islands, where they had one little boat and then another boat came along and then another one came. And, you know, you had different tribes and different populations that then intermarried and you had your genetic diversity. So it really is going to depend on your architecture and your technology level. If you have many short trips, fewer people per trip, if you really get one shot at it, you better load it up with as much genetic diversity as you can. Now the people and what their skills are, this is also a challenge. And we have a chapter that talks about what the skill sets need to be and how you set up governance. You know, not it, looking around the earth today, we all agree on the right kind of government, right? So how is it going to be different on board a ship? And people who set out might agree to one form of governance. The people who are born along the way might not like that so much and want to change it.
So in terms of the skill set, what is the thinking? I mean, presumably you want an engineering sort of person and you want someone who knows a lot about the human body. And I mean, is the idea currently the best idea to actually have, you know, quick learners who are, you know, who are focused in a particular area and then have a giant database of all human knowledge on a thumb drive? Or what's the, how do they figure out that problem?
You basically capture it right there. I think the ideal crew for an interstellar voyage won't be a lot different from the ideal crew for a Mars mission, except in terms of what the succession planning is. And what I mean for that is if you're going to Mars and you've got eight people, you want to have somebody who's a doctor who also knows how to do engineering, say, right? So, you know, maybe cross-training, or you have engineers who cross-train on how to be a paramedic in case the doctor gets hurt. So somebody who's a quick learner, has access to information, and can be cross-trained easily, I think is the ideal. However, some of the equipment is so specialized that cross-training won't work. I can imagine the person who's the expert in the fusion reactor, you know, is not going to have a lot of spare time to learn how to be a plumber.
Yeah.
Right? So you're going to have these specialists. And that's great if you have enough people on board where you have redundancy and all that. But then you have to start thinking about, well, wait a minute, if you're limited by human lifespan, this person's going to grow old and die potentially before you get to the destination. So you're going to have to train those next generations aboard ship on how to do these things. What if they don't want to do that?
I didn't ask for this, Dad.
I didn't ask for this, right? You know, I'll just give the example of my, I have two adult kids. I'm a physicist. Neither of my kids love math, and that's fine. I mean, to each their own.
Is it though?
It's fine. Okay. I mean, I pursued a different path than my parents, and I instilled in them, you know, if you find a field you like and you have passion for it, you'll never work a day in your life, right? Hmm. And so they're into different areas. My son in software sciences, psychology, and such, and my daughter's in nutrition. And they're really good at what they do, but they're not very mathematical. So that's okay. Hmm. But you're going to have somebody who's mathematical on the ship who can then do the engineering and the physics. So it's going to take a good population size, in my opinion, in order to get not only the genetic diversity, but the aptitude diversity that you'll need for maintaining the voyage.
Of course, talking about the sum of all human knowledge, in the last 2 years, our understanding of what computers can and will do in the future has been turned on its head with generative AI. And you devote a section of this book to the role of AI, and that role may not just be a simple repository for information, that actually AI could have a number of different specific roles within a generational ship. Can you talk me through what those are?
Well, again, this is one area where our author for this had his own ideas, and a lot of people have different ideas. It's difficult to distill it all into one section. But, you know, these smart systems, these AIs, and I'm taking for a moment the idea of a sentient AI off the table, a self-aware, self-directing AI, more of one that's an assistant to us. I think it's a brilliant idea to help make systems more resilient. Because apparently the way AIs work is they can take disparate input and come up with optimum ways to address problems very quickly based on all that disparate data and input. And they learn as they go, these neural programming languages. And on a complex system like a starship, having an AI assistant to keep an eye on things, to run things, to make, if not routine decisions, recommendations for decisions that flow to the human who ultimately makes the call of things that are significant, could reduce a lot of risk and enable us to have far fewer people on board to keep an eye on the systems that are on the spacecraft. Where I get difficulty is where you start deferring the decision-making to some kind of logical algorithm in an AI. And the example I would give to that is in our population today, you know, if we had to make a judgment call of medical treatment given to somebody at a certain age or at a certain stage of a disease versus not, you know, from a purely logical point of view, we would make some decisions that you and I as human beings would find to be abhorrent.
Yeah. If you are a particularly a geeky person who loves to get into the nitty gritty details, because I have to say, this is quite a technical book. It's called Interstellar Travel. It's Propulsion, Life Support, Communications, and the Long Journey. And it's co-edited by Les Johnson here and Kenneth Roy. And if you are of scientific mind or an engineer, you might find some of the ideas in it really, really interesting. But even if you aren't, just flicking through it, it's really, really fascinating to look at what we're considering when we're thinking about what we need to do to get humans from this star system to another. And that's always a good way to spend a bit of time, I find. Les Johnson, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Now, if you've ever seen the 1996 movie Twister, it's a cracker, you'll be aware of the idea of storm chasers. What you might not realize is that these people are not just thrill-seeking characters created by Hollywood. Real scientists actually do this work too. So what is it like to be on the trail of twisters? Well, Robin Tanamachi is Associate Professor in the Department of Earth, Atmospheric and Planetary Sciences at Purdue. She joins me now. Robin, welcome to the program. Define tornado for me versus a storm or a hurricane.
Right. So a tornado is a vertically oriented column of air that is rotating and is attached to a parent thunderstorm in some way. And it has to be rotating at a certain speed. So you have to have velocities in there of at least 29 meters per second or greater. And it's going to be a much smaller scale than something like a hurricane, which is going to be hundreds of kilometers across and, you know, last several days. A tornado may last only on the order of a few seconds to a few minutes and may only travel a few miles to maybe 100 miles in extreme cases. So there's a lot of variability within that definition of tornado. But the one thing that we do know is that they can threaten life and property. And so therefore, there's going to be a whole infrastructure in the United States associated with detection and warning for tornadoes so people can take action to protect themselves and their property.
Hmm. How they form still remains something of a mystery. Is that right?
That is correct. So we've gotten really good at forecasting where those ingredients are going to come together. And that is most frequently over the Great Plains region, so the central part of the lower 48 United States during the spring. And then in the early spring, there's a secondary season over the southeast United States. As we transition from winter into spring, there's a secondary season there. So we're pretty good at forecasting when those conditions are going to come together, say, you know, 5 to 8 days in advance. We have an organization called the Storm Prediction Center, which is located in the heart of our tornado-producing region in a city called Norman, Oklahoma, that I called home for about 13 years. And they issue daily forecasts several times a day for storm and tornado potential. They're not just looking for tornadoes. They're looking for things like strong winds and also hail. And, you know, hail is also another big concern for our insurance industry here in the United States because it also does billions of dollars in damage. In fact, we lose more insured losses to hail than we do to tornadoes every year. So they're on the lookout for those ingredients that come together and create thunderstorms that can produce those hazards. And yeah, in a particular year, we might see, you know, a little bit of fluctuation from the average, but on average, we end up with about 1,300 tornadoes per year. And the exact mechanism by which you get, you know, rotating thunderstorms circulation to concentrate down to the point where we can call it a tornado is still very much a mystery. And every time we do one of these field programs, we go out there with instruments like surface observing instruments, mobile mesonets, which are basically rolling weather stations, radiosondes, which is a phrase for a weather balloon, or my specialty, which is mobile Doppler radars. We take those out on the road. We take a very small, compact version of a National Weather Service radar out to the storm rather than waiting for the storm to come to us. And we use that to scan the storm at very close range and try to capture the changes in the wind fields and the vertical wind motions right before the tornado forms. But it's really, really hard to get data in the location that we need it, which is very close to the surface right when the tornado is forming. That whole process, that what we call corner flow collapse, happens in a matter of just a few seconds.
So how do you get close to these things to study them then? Because I'm imagining you in khakis driving furiously down a dirt road, wind in your hair, machines stuck to the side and inside the truck, and constantly trying to find which way one of these storms is going. But presumably a lot of it is social media, someone saying, look, there's a twister, and then driving in that direction. Or by the time someone posts something on the internet, is it too late?
By the time we see social media posts about it, generally the event is either ongoing or over, in which case we really want to be there ahead of time. So that
Do you get there ahead of time?
Yeah, in a lot of cases we do. So, and the way that this works is, you know, we have what we call the forecast funnel. So 5 to 8 days out, we're looking at, you know, a region on the order of a state or so. And then as the day gets closer, that region of interest kind of collapses. We look at all our forecast models and soundings and other data to refine that area and make it smaller. We travel there usually on the day before and pre-position. And then on the day of, we may be also repositioning ourselves based on how things evolve, you know, overnight, the night before, how other storms are influencing the storm of interest. And then we choose a target storm. And then once we've chosen a target storm, and there may be several that we could potentially reach, we have to commit ourselves to that target storm. We can't, you know, stop and change target storms in the middle of the chase. So once we've declared a target storm, that's when we go into work. Each of our teams has a job in a specific area around the storm. They're not all supposed to charge directly at the storm and try to get their instruments right in the path of the tornado like they do in the movies. We all surround the storm with kind of a network of instrumentation, and we all take different kinds of measurements that are all very complementary to each other. And we only get one shot at that once we are in position and try to capture this process of what we call tornado genesis, which is just a very fancy word for tornado formation. Try to capture that process with as many instruments as possible. And then we have to accurately, you know, log our deployments and duration of deployments and what kind of data we collected. So this is something that usually, you know, we hire graduate students to do and so they get training in how to do this, and it's psychologically kind of rigorous because you're in this very dynamic environment where, you know, light levels are changing, visibility's changing, and sometimes we have to, you know, pull up stakes and change plans in the middle of a deployment if things are evolving in a way that we don't necessarily expect them to. We teach our students above all to be safe and to not deploy if they don't feel safe deploying in a particular place. And so we always have an escape route available to us. So if we have to escape, we can pull up stakes and escape very quickly. And I've had to escape a few times, and in those cases, it's taken, you know, on the order of maybe 5 to 10 seconds for us to activate our escape plan and get out of there.
Presumably, these things are as dangerous as they look like on film. That if you get in the path of one of these things, you are facing, you know, severe hazard of danger or death. I mean, what does that feel like to be that close to something so powerful?
So, speaking as somebody who's chased storms for on the order of 20 years, as you know, first a graduate student and now a professor myself who leads my own field programs, there are certain what we call conceptual models, or sort of like ideas we have of how the storms are going to behave and how they're going to move. And so we operate with those presumptions in place. Like in the Central Great Plains region of the United States, typically a lot of our tornadic storms move from southwest to northeast. So we kind of plan with that storm motion in mind, and we situate our instruments with that storm motion in mind. And the time that I, you know, think back on very vividly to when we were attempting to observe a storm. I was not part of a field program in this particular year, but we observed a storm near El Reno, Oklahoma in 2013. And instead of that storm moving from southwest to northeast, it chose to take a swing to the right and actually came toward the southeast, toward our position where we were located. And as I mentioned, you know, it took 5 seconds for us to activate our escape plan and get out of there at that time. And that was really the only time in 20 years of chasing that I have actually felt a threat from the tornado itself. And unfortunately, that one did go on to take the lives of a few storm chasers that I really admired. But the number of storm chasers who've actually been killed and injured by the tornado itself is actually very, very small. It's on the order of about a dozen or so. Really, the bigger threat that we're facing when we're out there actually interacting with a storm is not from the storm and its hazards, which, you know, are certainly not trivial. I mean, we've got lightning and large hail and strong winds in addition to the tornado, poor visibility, rain curtains wrapping around the tornado that can conceal its location. All those things we definitely train for, but really the bigger threat is actually being on the roads with other people who are either chasing storms or just happen to be in the area by happenstance, who may or may not be paying attention, who may or may not be knowing what they're doing. And so by and large, a lot of the injuries and fatalities that are associated with storm chasing have been from traffic accidents, traffic collisions that have occurred in and around the storm and not necessarily, you know, from the storm itself.
No, I can imagine. I mean, I've driven in really torrential rain, and you can't see very far ahead of yourself. I mean, if you know there's a threat that that's going to get a lot more serious and there's a twister in your way, you can imagine people probably don't drive as carefully as they probably could. What about storm tourism then? These people who do this for fun, do you think these people who are setting up camp around these storms when you're trying to do your field work, are they a danger?
So the issue I have sometimes when I'm out doing field research is not necessarily with people who are on storm tours, and that is an actual thing that exists. And I actually do support the ethical storm chase tour industry, because to me, if you put 10 inexperienced people in a van with an experienced storm chaser who knows how to read radar, who knows how to read the sky and can keep that group out of danger, that's 10 fewer distracted drivers on the road who maybe don't know what they're doing, who don't know how to interpret radar, who don't know how to interpret meteorological data, and who are driving in a very distracted capacity while they're out there on the road. So I actually do encourage people, if they are interested in kind of dipping their toes in and finding out what storm chasing is like, hire one of these ethical storm chase tour companies to take you along for a 1 or 2 week ride and see what it's like. And you may be surprised by what you find out. It's actually kind of boring sometimes. There's a lot of driving involved.
Oh, you made it sound so cool.
Hot sun.
At the beginning, I was myself and the producer were like, we should do that. And now, boring,
The issue we have, though, sometimes when we're out doing field work is with, you know, some of these individuals who are out there who don't necessarily have a whole lot of experience and who are driving in a distracted capacity, don't know how to manage the very dynamic environment in and around the storm. And we've had situations where, say, there's one prospective target storm within like a 200 mile or so radius, about 300 kilometers or so. And, you know, every storm chaser in the Great Plains basically converges on that single storm. You can actually get traffic jams underneath a particular storm.
Oh,
and it may
gosh.
Be in a very rural area. So they'll be hammering on the one or two mobile internet towers that are available in that area. There'll be actual parking lots that form on the sides of these very rural roads. People get stuck in the mud, and then you've got this very dynamic environment where sometimes rain curtains wash through and you can get stuck in the mud on what was a perfectly dry road when you went out, may not be when you come back. And we've run into situations very occasionally where, you know, I'm trying to deploy a radar truck and I literally can't find a place to park it. And of course, the radar truck being very large is a difficult thing to park to begin with. So sometimes I'll send a scout vehicle out ahead to try to block off a spot for me to park. We've also had situations where we just are completely compromised in our ability to do a scientific deployment, and we've had to actually abandon scientific deployments because of the crowding.
Well, I mean, and you would imagine that if you had an incident like that where the twister or the tornado changed direction and you were all stuck in the mud because of this traffic, that could be the perfect storm, no pun intended.
That is my worst nightmare.
Yeah.
You know, that is my absolute worst nightmare, is that there'll be a morass like that at some point. And unfortunately, you know, it's I feel like, you know, the pessimist in me says it's just a matter of time until something like that happens. And I cross my fingers every year that we're not going to see a situation like that happening. And I think the El Reno tornado of 2013 was about as close as we came to having something like that happen. And we're lucky that more people didn't get killed or injured by that tornado than were.
And just before we go, I'm just reading this. I want to make sure I have it right. Some of these tornadoes travel as fast as 200 meters per second or 295 miles, 475 kilometers an hour. Is that right?
So the record that we have for the translational motion of the tornado is about 180 miles per hour.
Right.
And I'm failing to do that conversion in my head right now, but you can do it on a piece of paper.
About 300 and something.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was in a sub-vortex of the El Reno tornado, which is the one that I was just talking about. That tornado was just extraordinary in every aspect. It had sub-vortices, which are smaller tornadoes inside the main tornado that were in and of itself, you know, strong tornadoes. And that was what really caused the fatalities. It was not the fault of any of the storm chasers that got caught up in it. They were just blindsided by something that was unprecedented, really. So typically, you're not going to have to deal with tornadoes that are moving faster than, say, 60 miles an hour. And, you know, you can easily outrun those in a typical vehicle, assuming you can get out onto the road and get out of the way.
What about a Sharknado?
Oh, goodness. I have yet to see one of those that's not contained on a screen.
But Firenados are real, right? Firenados do actually happen. Have you ever witnessed one of those?
Yeah. In fact, we had one of those out in the Park City fire out in California, or Park fire out in California just this past week, where what happens sometimes is that the fire will actually cause stretching of pre-existing rotation that's kind of in the environment around it. And, you know, in physics, we call it conservation of angular momentum. It's the same principle by which, you know, a figure skater will raise their arms and start spinning faster. They'll pull their arms in and spin faster. The stretching of the pre-existing circulation in the environment will actually cause the entire fire to rotate and get more concentrated. And you can actually have fire whirls, or even what we call pyronados, which are tornadoes that are filled with fire. But those are usually limited to the area where the fire is actively burning. And so you don't have to worry about those, you know, straying outside of that domain. But that can pose a hazard to people who are attempting to mitigate and control the fire or keep it from moving. And it can cause additional damage to structures just from the addition of the wind in addition to the fire.
Such a fascinating job you have, Robin. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. That's Robert Tanamachi. She's associate professor in the Department of Earth, Atmospheric and Planetary Sciences at Purdue University. Thanks, Robin.
Thanks a lot. This was fun.
Now, life after death has been the subject of religious discourse and indeed fiction for millennia. But somewhat bizarrely, among modern medical researchers, it has become sort of an accepted reality. So what does this profound discovery mean for critical care and resuscitation, and indeed for our sense of when someone is alive or dead? Sam Parney is director of critical care and resuscitation research at the New York University School of Medicine and author of Lucid Dying, the New Science Revolutionizing How We Understand Life and Death. He joins me now. Sam, great to have you on the program again. If you wouldn't mind just maybe starting off telling me about the work that you're doing with people and how you get access to human beings who are on the brink of death or technically dying.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be back. You know, I'm an intensive care physician, and my specialty is trying to resuscitate, in other words, restart the heart in people who would otherwise be declared dead, and essentially bring them back to life and preserve their organs and their brain so they can have a meaningful recovery. You have to remember, it's estimated that almost 70 million people die every year, and of those, close to 9 million just die from heart attacks. So many people who die actually die from a potentially reversible medical condition like a heart attack, but they stay dead because the only treatments we have to offer them after their heart stops is simple CPR, which is really outdated. It's almost 70 years old. And so what we're working on is developing new methods to try to restart the heart and preserve the brain after people die. And we can do that because science has discovered that, contrary to the way that society and most people perceive death, in other words, we think of death as lights out. We think of when the heart stops and someone's died. That is a rapid degeneration from 100 to zero with nothing left. And the reality is actually, after we die, incredibly, the body goes through a hibernation-like of state where actually this lasts many hours of time. So if we can relabel death and remove that end and think of it as a treatable condition, we can restore life to many tens of millions of people in the coming decades.
Sorry, you said hours after someone's heart has stopped, you can potentially reverse that?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's the scientific basis by which we are operating. And I can give you some evidence of that. Again, I realize this is very challenging for people because we've been conditioned to think of life and then there's a binary death and we think they're totally separate. And once you label somebody death, that is the absolute end. But it really isn't. For instance, in 2019, a group of researchers at Yale University studied, they took 32 pig brains. These were decapitated pig heads from a slaughterhouse. These were not experimental animals. These were animals who were killed for their meat. But instead of discarding those brains, they took them to the lab 4 hours after the animals had been killed. Now, again, you can't be more dead than decapitated dead. And they, right? And they, so, but I mean, it's not a play with words. We're not talking about the process leading to death. We're talking about death and post-mortem beyond death. So they took these and then they connected them to a catheter and then they gave them a combination of medications that preserves the brain and organs better. And they were able to, they did that over up to 10 hours and they were able to restore brain function in all 32 brains. So the brains came back to life after death, right? And that's the premise. And then what they ended up doing in 2022...
Sorry. Decapitated pig's brains 4 hours later came back to life in what way, Sam? Like just you got a little bit of electricity or actually...
No. Every function that they tested came back. Every component of the brain was restored. There was no damage to the brains whatsoever.
What? Absolutely. But what about this idea that when our heart stops and we start getting oxygen to the brain, we get tissue death and atrophy? But what about all that?
That's a great point you bring up. So you see, we have been mistakenly taught as doctors, and this is disseminated to the public, that after the heart stops and the brain is deprived of oxygen, the brain becomes permanently damaged after only 5 or 10 minutes. Hmm. But that is totally incorrect. And that is what has prevented progress in this area. What's now been discovered is that after 5 or 10 minutes, so it's nuanced. Yes, after 5 or 10 minutes of oxygen deprivation, the process of cell damage leading to cell death starts, but it doesn't end for hours, possibly days. And that's why I said when we die, our brain and our organs go into a hibernation-like state. If you leave us alone, ironically, the damage that occurs is when doctors resuscitate, they do CPR. When you put oxygen back into that mix, the oxygen becomes toxic and then it accelerates cell death. But what it really means is that we've identified a window where we can treat this oxygen-mediated injury, which is what the group at Yale did. And they were able to show perfectly that you can restore total function to brains hours post-mortem.
What are the ethical implications if we... if we have the ability to perform something like this on humans, is it possible we bring back people who are severely mentally ill or mentally damaged? How do we advance this research without putting real people in risk of sort of a horrible limbo?
Well, I see it completely the opposite, actually, because what this has proven is that you can take people. Think of all the young people who die, let's say athletes who die and are pronounced dead. Think of all the news stories every day where people are pronounced dead, otherwise healthy individuals who were stabbed, who ran into accidents. Think of all the, say, middle-aged men who die out of a sudden heart attack. All those, what these scientists were able to show is that those people who are truly dead, their organs are salvageable if you can initiate the right treatments instead of giving up. Today, society gives up because they label it the end, but that's not true anymore. Hmm. And so actually what the Yale scientists did, incredibly, 3 years after that, in 2022, they went a step further. They took what they had developed and they enhanced it and they combined it with a sort of a heart-lung bypass machine that is able to flow blood better, and they connected it up to dead pigs. 1 hour after the pigs had been killed, this is not just the brain now, it's the whole body. And they were able to show that they compared that to the best of the best that's available in hospitals. And they were able to show that over 6 hours, they could restore function in all the vital organs, including the brain, the heart, you know, kidney, liver, everywhere. And so while they were concerned about the ramifications for society, because essentially, if you can restore life to all the organs, you've restored life to a dead mammal, to a pig. And that is now the challenge that we have, is to initiate the same thing in humans who are otherwise being declared dead, who have a meaningful life ahead of them. So I'm not talking about people who've got untreatable diseases, let's say cancer that's spread all over their body and their organs are all totally damaged and there are no treatments for them. But I'm talking about the many millions of people all over the world who die prematurely and who are otherwise in good health. that could be revived. So that is what we are trying to establish today.
So where is that research at? I mean, are there machines that we could use today to get someone who's had a heart attack and died on scene? The paramedics put them in the ambulance. A couple of hours later, we can hook them up to something and they could come back fully? Like, how far away are we from that? And what sort of technology do you need for it?
I think at this point, we need to take baby steps before we can run. But I think the potential is there for certainly a couple of hours after somebody has died. Right now, I think where we're looking at is up to an hour to start with. And the machines exist because what the Yale scientists did was there was nothing extraordinary in the sense that it was extraordinary, but it wasn't. They took essentially what are heart-lung bypass machines that are available and are used all over the world, but they combined it with a combination of brain-protective medications. And these are all available, cheap. Things like magnesium, things like an antibiotic called minocycline. But these all have organ-preserving properties if you use them. So they created this by looking at the science and putting it together, and they were able to show that it works. So we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We just need to put the pieces together that are currently available, but use them correctly. And that is what we are currently trying to do at my institution in New York.
Okay. So, I mean, this sounds very, very important work. What are the next steps in your research? And are there other clinicians and other centers working alongside you to try and push this forward? Because this is, you're talking about reversing what we typically call death. I mean, what is your study design and what further steps do you need before we establish an emergency response center in every major city that uses one of these ECMO machines and this cocktail of drugs to resuscitate people when they've died?
Yeah, there are many others. There are many others. For example, there are a group of German physicians who've actually developed a machine that's very similar to what the Yale scientists used. And it's basically one of these heart-lung bypass machines, but it's importantly, it combines it with a cocktail of brain-preserving medications. And they've already been using it in humans, and they've published a study where they took 69 people who had received CPR, but CPR had failed to start their hearts, and they would have been declared dead. But instead of letting them be declared dead, they connected them up to this particular device with a cocktail of drugs, and they were able to restore life to almost 50% of those people, which is incredible.
They show no major brain or heart damage?
Most of them did not have brain damage. Most of them recovered neurologically or with respect to their brain, which is very important. So yes, there are groups of us who understand this and are trying to implement it. I am working with my colleagues in my institution to now implement an upgraded version of resuscitation. We have been using cocktails of brain-preserving medications since 2019, and we found that it doubled the survival in our patients. So this is something that is active and being fostered.
How soon, looking at the timelines and the work that you're doing, is it likely that we would see this in a clinical setting?
As I say, we're working on this. We're hoping to start within less than a year, and others will hopefully upgrade their treatments as well, and they can follow the lead and do that.
I wanted to finish off talking with you because as an expert in resuscitation, you often are dealing with people who have gone through the barrier of what, they would have expected to be death and then have come back, flatlining and beyond. And I'm wondering, in the last few years, do any of the stories or experiences of patients stand out to you in terms of what they said they felt or experienced while they were technically dead?
Well, one of the remarkable things that happens when people die is that most activities shut down. But incredibly, in this hibernation state where the brain becomes dysfunctional, it actually releases activities that are helpful to the person. So, for example, the body tries to initiate mechanisms to save itself, and it expresses genes that repair any damage. At the same time, what seems to happen is that we call this disinhibition. In other words, you get activation of dormant pathways. What this seems to do is that it enables a person who's gone through death to suddenly access huge amounts of their own consciousness. So from the perspective of doctors like me, they seem to be dead and lifeless. But internally, those people describe themselves as having more lucid consciousness, a higher, sharper sense of awareness. And then they describe incredibly feeling that they separate from themselves. They're watching doctors and nurses save them. but they're getting information almost like a field. It's almost like they get information in 360 degrees all over both what was being said, what was being done. And then what's really remarkable is a person who's now in this gray zone of death, you know, death and just beyond, suddenly starts to reevaluate their entire life. Everything that they've done is re-experienced. Every interaction, every thought, every intention that they've had is re-experienced, analyzed at the same time, almost like millions of sets of data. But they analyze everything they've done purely from the perspective of morality and ethics. And they come to learn that their life had had more purpose and meaning than simple social measures of success that they had been engaged with. And that's why when they come back and they are more altruistic, they're transformed. They try to find a deeper purpose and meaning to life.
Oh man, I'm not looking forward to dying. I'm already someone who's laden with guilt for the mistakes I've made in the past. So just adding that on, a little kick of spice at the end, I'm not looking forward to that.
But I think, you know, you have to realize that this experience is actually a highly educational experience. So people relive everything that they've done, but they also relive how other people felt during their interactions. And so sometimes the experience, of course, leads to a lot of embarrassment when people look at their errors and how they've conducted themselves. But at the same time, incredible amounts of joy where they've helped others and been of assistance. But either way, what comes out of it is a highly positive experience. It's a learning experience. By positive, I mean, even if it was painful, they've learned something from it. In the same way that you and I may have had hardships in life, but when we look back and we've learned something, we use it to progress. So there is a deep recognition that every moment, every action, every intention counts. And that's why when they come back, they try to change the way they were. And as one person said, in his experience, he recognized that he had failed as a human being. But he said, at least when they gave me a second chance, I wanted to go back at least and say I got a C-. And that's the transformative effect of the experience.
Wow. Sam Parnia is the author of Lucid Dying, the new science revolutionizing how we understand life and death. Sam, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Love that feature. And it was one of our highlights of the year, but there were so many more. If you love this program, if you this is the first time listening to it, do listen back to the podcast. You'll find it in the News Talk app powered by Go Loud, and let people know about our science program, because this time of year, people happen upon a show and it could become your next favorite thing. Hopefully. Let's hope you listen with us into 2025. But that's it from us on Future Proof for 2024. Thank you for listening to us throughout the year. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, Rory Galvin, and everyone who helped with the programme. Thank you for listening. We hope you've been having a wonderful Christmas and you all have a happy new year. We'll speak to you again in 2025.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.